Go ahead and open your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. We started going through this letter about a month ago, and I don't know about you, but it's been very helpful for me. Peter writes this letter just to remind us all. He's writing this to a group of people spread out through this part of the world called Asia Minor. He lists a bunch of different cities. So this letter traveled around to different cities and different churches, different families of believers in these different cities, but they all had something in common. And he writes at the very beginning of 1 Peter, he says, he calls these people elect exiles, chosen exiles, and that describes exactly who they are and the situation that they're in. He writes to a group of people that are living in exile. And he doesn't just mean physically. I mean, some of these people probably were physical exiles, refugees that were sent out, maybe from Rome. We know that one of the emperors had expelled all of the Jews from Rome, had basically said, if you're a Jew, you need to leave the city. And so there were refugees that were sent out all over the world because of that. And many of these believers probably were real physical refugees, exiles. But that's not what Peter really is talking about. He writes to these people as people that are exiles no matter where they are, right? I mean, Peter himself is writing this from Rome. And there's others that are not in exile, that are not refugees, but they still are exiles. His point is that it's not where you are that makes you an exile. It's the fact that you're not home and your home is not on this earth. That you are exiles no matter where you go, no matter where you live. Because you, as a people that have been called out of slavery and brought into a new kingdom and brought under the rule of a new and good and gracious king, you now are citizens of a different world, of a different land, of a different kingdom. So no matter where you go, people, is what he's telling them, you're exiles. And because of that reality, because you are now exiles on this earth, and that's God's doing. Remember, we talked about that at the very beginning. This is God's doing. God has chosen them and brought them into exile. God's the one who sent them there. Because of that, they will, as they live the rest of their lives, they will live in exile and live on the margins of their culture and in their cities. They will live on the margins. They've been pushed to the margins. They will face suffering. They will face persecution. And he's writing to them how to engage and how to live in light of that reality. Now, this for us is very, very timely. And for me, it's very timely. Because whether or not you've accepted this reality or not, maybe you're still living in denial about this, but you are an exile, and I am an exile. That we are not at the center of our culture. And maybe for a long time, the church in the Western world thought that we did have a privileged place in our culture where the church in some ways was at the center, and people thought that people respected Christians at some point, maybe for like a small period of our history. But that's not what God envisioned for his church, and that wasn't meant to be the reality. That maybe lasted for a little while, but the reality is that if we're called out of darkness and called in to his kingdom, we are not at the center of our culture and the center of our world. We are, by default, exiles no matter where we go. And that now has become the reality, right? Where to be a Christian is not a privileged place in society. It's seen as weird. Maybe it's seen as extreme. It's seen as maybe even a threat or a danger by many around us, our friends, our neighbors, the people we work with. Maybe they see you as irrelevant or just kind of different, but maybe they see you as a threat. And if you really believe what the Bible teaches, maybe you're seen as an extremist. And that's real, friends. That's real today. I don't say that to scare you, but I say that to make sure that we all accept this reality that if we are called out of darkness into his light, then we are by default exiles, and that's a place we need to be comfortable because that's where God has sent us. We're not meant to be at the center of our culture. We're not meant to be at the center of our world. We are meant to be a people that live life on the margins. And it's from the margins that we offer hope and life to the refugees all around us. So we are a people, just to remind us, that live in exile. We are in exile right now. And so Peter's letter to the exiles in Asia Minor is a letter and a message that we need to hear, because he's writing to them to help them to know, how do you live life on the margins? How do you live life when you are different and you're on the margins and maybe you're seen as weird or different or maybe even a threat, and maybe because of that you experience suffering and persecution, maybe you experience marginalization, maybe you're dismissed. How do we engage the world around us and live life in our neighborhoods and in our workplaces and in our homes when this is the reality of who we are? That's what this letter is about, is how do we live life on the margins? And Peter doesn't start out his letter telling them what to do, which is very, very helpful, right? He doesn't just jump into, here's what you need to do, Christians. He starts out reminding them of who they are and of the salvation that God has given them. He starts out reminding them that this is a position that God has put them in, that God has rescued them and sent them into this exile, and that it's God's doing. And he reminds them of the salvation that God has given them. And then starting in verse 3, he reminds them that God is the one who has caused them to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and that he has saved them, that he has given them an amazing salvation, called them to be a part of his family, and that there's a future salvation that we look forward to one day. So even though we are not at home here on this earth, and even though we are in exile, we look forward to a future salvation that is being kept in heaven for us, and that we are being guarded for that day. And that this salvation, that this future salvation has been promised to us, and that even the prophets he talks about prophesied about this future salvation, right? That this is something that all of history has been waiting and looking forward to, and the prophets look forward to this future salvation, and that in Jesus Christ it has arrived, that we have this now. And that even though now we face trials and persecution, he says, that these are being used by God to strengthen, to test our faith and strengthen us as we await this future salvation. So don't be surprised when trials and suffering and persecution comes. It's a tool that God is using to strengthen, to test and strengthen your faith. And that he is keeping you during that suffering and in those trials, he is keeping you and guarding you for the salvation that you one day will experience, which is God himself, that we await that day. So Peter, he doesn't jump into, okay, you're in exile, church, and here's what you need to do. He says, church, you are in exile. You've been called into God's kingdom, which means you're no longer at home in this earthly kingdom or the kingdoms of this earth. And in that reality, you're going to face marginalization and suffering and persecution. But here's the biggest thing you need to know and remember, that God has called you into his kingdom and has rescued you, has saved you. And one day you will inherit that kingdom, and you will be saved fully one day to be with God. And until that day, in the midst of your suffering, he's using it to strengthen your faith and to show that your faith is genuine and to prepare you for that day. So don't be surprised by suffering and persecution. Now in verse 13, which is where we are today, he then jumps into what we need to do. He jumps into actually how we live in light of this reality. Now, let me remind us real quick about the different ways. So if we are a people that that face marginalization, persecution, suffering, because we are by default now under a different king and we're a part of a different kingdom, and that isn't always okay to the world around us, there's different ways we respond to that. Some of us become defensive against the world, right? We start to view it us versus them. Some of us become where we want to isolate ourselves, right, and go hide. Others of us don't want to be different, so we accommodate and just become, we want to be relevant to the world around us, and we forget that we've been called out to a new kingdom and called out of darkness and into the light, and we instead just try to be relevant to the culture and accommodate, and we stop being faithful to our King. So we respond in different ways, but Peter says none of those are the answer. Right? Throughout his letter, he calls the church and he calls these believers as they live in exile not to become defensive against the world, not to isolate ourselves from the world and hide from the world, not to just accommodate and try to become relevant and stop being faithful to Jesus as we relate to the world around us, but instead he calls us to be present within the world but faithful to God in the midst of that. He calls us to a faithful presence in the midst of our culture, in the midst of our world. And as we get into verse 13, and as you think about how you, in the midst of your neighbors and your workplaces and your homes and wherever you are, as you are in exile in those places, he will be calling us to a faithful presence in the midst of those spheres of life, to be present within, to not isolate ourselves, to not put up walls and become defensive and us versus them, but to not stop being faithful to our King and start trying to just be relevant and accommodate to our world. Instead, he calls us to be faithful but still present within those different spheres of influence. So students, kids, and I don't say kid, I'm speaking some of the younger ones, but also college students, and grad students. I mean, you are in the midst of probably a world in a school where you are 1%, right? Where 99% of everyone else around you believes differently than you do, right? I mean, those of you at OSU, right? How much of a minority are those of you that say, I want to be faithful and follow Christ? A huge minority, and I know there's a lot of Christians like you, but as we look at the grand scale of things, right, you are this small, tiny percentage. And the pressure for you, and for those of you that are even younger, for those that are in elementary school, middle school, high school, the pressure for you is to either isolate yourselves and just create little subcultures where you don't have to deal with all of the world around you, right? Or the pressure is to become defensive against. Or the pressure is for you maybe to not be different at all, right? Just to try to be relevant and to be like those around you. We face this pressure. For those of us in our workplaces, if you work in a place where most of the people you work with do not believe the same way you believe, then you face that pressure as well. Maybe you come from a home where you're the only believer in your home, or from a family where you're the only one who follows Christ. Maybe for all of us, I think the neighborhoods that we live in and the city that we live in, those who want to follow Christ, we're in the minority. So we all face this pressure. How do we face this? How do we live as exiles who are faithful to Jesus, are faithful to our King, and yet not isolating ourselves or to becoming defensive against the world? How do we actually be a blessing to our neighbors, to our friends, and to our family? How do we actually be present within those worlds, within your school at OSU and in your high school or in your workplaces? How do you be a blessing and a light to those places while at the same time remaining different and faithful to Christ in those places? That's what Peter's talking about here. That's what this is about. And he starts in verse 13 to get very practical. And he gives us our first command. If you look at verse 13, Peter says, therefore, and I'm in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, says, therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Here's the first thing that Peter calls us to. Welcome. Not that. He says, here's the focus that the exile has to have. The focus is looking to God's future grace. This must be our focus. And here's the first command that he gives us. In the entire book, the first thing that he actually commands us to, it's not prepare your minds for action. It's not be sober-minded. The first command is set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The first thing that he calls us to as exiles, as people that have been rescued into a new kingdom with a new king, is to set our hope fully on the grace that will be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, he precedes that with two phrases. He says, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded. And those are two things that we do that describe how we set our hope, all right? So the command is for us to set our hope on the grace that will be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, what is the grace that will be brought to us? What has he just talked about in chapter 1? He's talked about this salvation, right? That God has caused us to be born again. It's not our doing, it's his doing. He came and caused you to be born again. And that through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that there is a salvation, there's a rescue that one day is going to happen where we will be brought back into perfect relationship with our King, with our Creator. That grace or that gift, that's what grace means, it's a gift, nothing that we deserved, that is what we have experienced, and that's what we look forward to, and that's what we're being guarded for through the work of our God and Savior. And he says, set your hope fully, completely on that grace. And that's why he's just spent the first 12 verses talking about the salvation that you've been given as exiles through God and the work of his Son, Jesus Christ. He spent so much time focusing on that because this is the most important thing. That as exiles, we first and foremost have to set our hope on this. Set our hope on the gospel. Set our hope on God's rescue. Set our hope on what God has accomplished for us through Jesus Christ. This is a decision and a posture. It's not something we stumble into. I mean, this is consciously deciding to do this, right? It's us actually stopping and thinking, I have to set my hope on this. And how we do that, right? He says, preparing your minds for action. The actual phrase there is girding up the loins of your mind, which is a really weird phrase. But in this context, in the first century, they wore these long flowing robes, tunics that they would wear, men and women. And if you wanted to go out and work, if you were going to do something, some sort of action, whether it was to go to battle or to go run, although I don't know how many of them ran for exercise in this day and age, but probably not a lot because they had pretty tough lives already. Go out in the fields, whatever it is, if you're going to go to action, you're not going to do that with like your robes hanging down around your ankles because you're going to trip. So literally they would grab their robes and pull them up and tie them around their waists. That's how they would prepare for action. And he says, gird up the loins of your mind, which basically is saying, get your minds ready for action. Be in a position of readiness. Okay, be in a position of readiness. And then he says, being sober-minded. Again, it's sober-minded is this picture of a mind that's not distracted. That's not distracted by a million different things around us, but it's focused. So this is a conscious decision. This is a position and a mindset of readiness and focus to set our hope on our future salvation and the grace that will be brought to us. This is a mindset that every day we are consciously deciding and realizing that we have to wake up and actually recalibrate our minds to refocus on the gospel and the grace that has been promised to us. That by default, our minds are quickly distracted by a million different things. And our default position is not ready. Our default position is distracted. And so this is a conscious decision to recalibrate and refocus and make sure that our minds are ready and set on the grace that has been promised to us and will be brought to us when Jesus Christ comes back to bring the final salvation. So this is a conscious decision. He says, set your minds on this hope. And this is the very first command that he gives us. And the most important thing for us as exiles is that we realize that this earth and this world is not our home. That we are citizens of another kingdom. That we don't grow comfortable here. That we don't grow distracted. But we realize that life is short. That we're in exile every single day, and we long for and eagerly await and are prepared for the day when we will get to be restored to our King and live under his rule physically forever. That we are focused on that and longing for that. Now, does this create, because here's what I would think if I were hearing this, well, this is just going to make a bunch of weirdo Christians who are always checked out from reality, right? Heads are in the clouds. They stop caring about the world around them. Is this the picture of a hyper-spiritual Christian who's done with the physical things of this world and could care less about their neighbors, their workplaces, their cities? Is that what Peter's talking about here? Because if we're thinking, okay, we need to be a people that are focused on a future salvation that will be ours one day, does that cause us then to check out and stop caring about the present? Does that cause us to get our heads in the clouds and stop caring about the people right around us? Does that cause us to be just a bunch of hyper-spiritual Christians who could care less about our neighbors? No, short answer. And we'll go on. We're not going to get too far into this. But Peter goes on in his letter, and this is just a preview to talk about how these believers cannot check out. He says they need to be engaged with their neighbors, with their unbelieving spouses, with their bosses, with the people that are ruling over them, and that they need to pray for them, and they need to care about them. So this doesn't cause us to be a bunch of people that have checked out from this present world and we're just like floating in the clouds, thinking about eternity, could care less about the present. Peter goes on to talk very concretely and tangibly about how we engage the world around us and how we need to care for it and how we need to think about it. So we don't check out. In fact, when Jeremiah, and you've probably heard this, we've probably talked about this before, as a church, but in Jeremiah, when he writes to Israel, they were in a very similar situation. The nation of Israel had been exiled literally into the nation of Babylon. They had been taken out from their home and brought into Babylon. And Jeremiah the prophet writes to these exiles. He says, while you're in exile, here's what I want you to do as you're in exile. He says, build houses and live in them. And let me put this up here. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and don't decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find welfare. So Jeremiah writes to the Israelites who are in exile and says, don't check out. He says, settle down. Right? Multiply, have families, build houses, plant gardens, be physically present, and seek the welfare of Babylon and the city that you have been exiled into. Because I've sent you here and I'm not sending you away anytime soon. You're going to be here for a while. So settle down and start seeking the welfare of the place where I've sent you. It's a very similar posture to what Peter calls us to as exiles, that we are likewise in spiritual exile and we don't check out. Yes, we focus. We have to have a mind and heart that are set on the future salvation that we will one day inherit when Jesus Christ is revealed, when he comes back to rescue us and bring us into a new heaven and a new earth that he will prepare for us. We need to be set on that and not grow comfortable and distracted here, which is so easy to do. And it requires a conscious, everyday decision to set our minds. But as we do that, we don't check out. We don't stop caring. We don't stop caring about the physical world. We don't stop caring about our neighbors and our workplaces. Instead, we live within those in a way that is shaped by our future hope. So we are a people that look to God's future grace and set our mind on that. Now here's the second thing Peter calls them to. So he says, set your minds completely on the hope that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And as you do that, you need to do this in a way that you are distinct and set apart and different from the world around you. He calls them, second, to be a distinctive, set apart, holy people. Verse 14, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. Verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also shall be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Peter here in these verses intentionally uses some words and some language that describe, they're really similar to some of the language that the Old Testament prophets Moses would use to describe Israel. And Peter's being very purposeful about that. It's not an accident. Obedient children was a term, the children of God, that often Moses and the prophets would use to describe Israel. And this call, he says, be holy for I am holy, is something that Moses wrote, that God called his people to. So he very intentionally is referring back to Israel, and specifically when God had rescued them out of slavery from Egypt and was bringing them to a new place, a future hope, a future land, and they were refugees, they were exiles. All the language here is really, really similar to that. He says, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And he says, as it is written. So that's a clue that he's referring back to something that's already been written. And this is a phrase that comes multiple times in Leviticus. Leviticus 11:44 says, for I am the Lord your God, and this is God speaking to Israel. By the way, let me say this real quick. Leviticus is a book of a bunch of rules that none of us like to read. There's just rules for everything. Rules for what clothes you wear, rules for how to do sacrifices, rules for how to eat, rules for how to care for each other, rules for how to work. I mean, there's rules for everything, which we like automatically are like, I don't want to hear the rules. So we don't, you know, this Leviticus is kind of a hard book for us sometimes, but it's an important one. And Leviticus is all about God telling his people as he's bringing them to this promised place, he's telling them how he wants them to live as his people. He's telling them, here's what life looks like under my rule. When I'm your king, here's what life looks like. Verse 44 of chapter 11, he says, for I'm the Lord your God, consecrate yourselves therefore and be holy for I am holy. You recognize that phrase? Be holy for I am holy. Leviticus 20:26, you shall be holy to me for I the Lord am holy and I have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine. Says, I've called you to be mine. You're my people. And therefore, you need to be holy, for I am holy. Now, as I said earlier, holiness is not a popular thing to talk about in the church today. For some of us, it draws memories of legalistic, rule-saturated church experiences from your past. Maybe you grew up in a church that was all about, like, do this, do this, don't do this. Like, you're not allowed to. I grew up in a part of my childhood in a Southern Baptist church, and it was like, don't. What was it? Don't smoke, don't drink. Wait, don't smoke, don't chew, or go with girls who do. Is that what it is? Don't drink, don't chew, or go with girls who do. Like that was like the golden rules, the three things. Whatever it was, don't you know? You grew up in a church or in some kind of faith community where it was all about the rules. Do this, don't do this, and God has rescued you and shown you that it's not about what you do, but it's about what he's done, right? Hopefully that's something you've experienced. So then when you think about rules now, maybe it makes you feel a little bit like, that's hard for me because of that experience. For some, maybe when you hear holiness, you just think of weird, out of touch Christians, right? That are just weird because they're all about being separate and different. I don't want to go too much into that for the sake of not offending anyone here. But I think we all have experienced that. The like, I'm so holy, right? I'm so holy. But for God, holiness Now think about this. And we read in Psalm 96 at the beginning of our service, the splendor of his holiness. Worship the Lord in the splendor, the beauty of his holiness. For God, holiness is essential to who he is. It's part of who God is, that he is set apart and different. That everything he does is good and right and perfect. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing, isn't it? That God is a God who is good, and that God is a God who is love, and that God is a God that is holy, and that these realities don't contradict each other, but they go hand in hand. That part of how God is good and loving is that he's holy and different. It shows us, and it should tell us, if that's true, it should tell us that then for us to live different than God, for us to be stuck in our sin is not a place of goodness, that it's bad for us, that it's a place of death and misery and sadness. But to be called out of that and to be his, to be called out of that darkness and that misery and that despair, and to be brought into his family and be set apart and to be made holy like he is holy, that that is a place of life and joy and happiness. Holiness is not a bad thing, friends. To be set apart is a beautiful thing because it means that we've been rescued out of despair and brought into life. We need to view it that way. To be holy, to be set apart, means that Leviticus 26, that we are his. That we are his. And that's where life and joy is found. To be his. So holiness is a beautiful thing. In our holiness, God setting us apart is not a killjoy to life. It's not a killjoy. Instead, it's a life-giving place to be. There's no better place to be than living under the good rule of our gracious King. There's no better place to be. So God calls us to be holy, for he is holy. The primary reason God calls us to holiness is because of that, because he is holy and we are his people, and that is a good thing. But here's a secondary thing. God also calls us to be holy, and here's kind of a secondary effect, because it's essential to our mission. Because there is a world around us that desperately needs to see that God is good and that he offers life and that life under his rule is a good thing, that to come under his reign is a good thing. There's a world around us, we have neighbors and friends that need to hear that good news. They need to hear that there's a good God who offers them life. And our holiness is essential to that message. Our holiness is essential to that message. The book of Leviticus. Now, here's what Leviticus is really about. This is from the book Everyday Church. The book of Leviticus is about God creating a new society through his word, which is distinctive in every way. In this way, Israel will display the holiness of God in a way that attracts the nations to find blessing in God as God promised to Abraham. Stop there for a second. Here's what Leviticus is about. Here's why God called Israel out of Egypt and he set them apart. And he said, I'm going to make you a holy nation. He didn't set them apart from the rest of the nations because he didn't care about anyone else. He set them apart so that they could shine brightly and show how good and glorious God is to the nations around them. And as they live as a holy people set apart under God's reign, the nations see through them how good and loving and gracious God is. They see a life-giving reality that they don't have. And God uses that to bring the nations to him. It's missional, right? Their holiness is part of how God is going to draw the nations to himself. It's part of how he will bring the good news to the world around them is through the holiness of his people. They need to look different than the nations, so that they are set apart in both different but at the same time attractive. So God, Leviticus, is intended to create this distinctive people by shaping every aspect of life individually and corporately. And that's why Leviticus literally covers like every part of life, from what you wear to what you eat to what you do, covers every part, because God cares about all of our life. It's not just about what the people did in the temple, it's about what they did in the market. This holiness knows no boundaries. It defines our friendships, our marriages, work, leisure, finances, and politics. Holiness is as much about what you do on Monday morning on the factory floor as it is about what you do on Sunday morning in a church gathering. It's as much about the kind of neighbor you are as the kind of church member you are. It's as much about who you are when you're holding a steering wheel as about who you are when holding a Bible. And like Leviticus, Peter is going to spell out what it means for the church to be distinctive in every area of life. But the headline is, be holy because I am holy. Be distinctive because I am distinctive. Friends, we have nothing to offer the world around us if we're not a people that are holy. So if we fall into the trap, and this is the pressure for all of us, as we exist in schools, in colleges, in workplaces, in neighborhoods where we are the minority because God has called us into exile. He's called us out of darkness to be a holy, set apart people. And the pressure is for us to accommodate, because we want to be relevant to the world around us and to our neighbors and friends. We want to be relevant. We don't want to be different. And so we stop being faithful. We stop following Jesus in ways that maybe make you look different from your neighbors and friends and coworkers. We stop being faithful to what he's called us to, and we accommodate. We accommodate to it. Now, this is really interesting. Peter doesn't call them to be different from everyone around them. He's not like us versus them. It's not us versus them. He calls them to be different from who they used to be. It's us versus who we are now versus who we used to be. And this is really helpful. Miroslav Volf says, Peter warns the Christians against certain behaviors, but the force of it is not, do not be as your neighbors are. It's not us versus them. The force of it is, do not be as you were. When our identity is forged primarily through the negative process of the rejection of the beliefs and practices of others, we've pushed others away from ourselves and we keep them at a distance. But only when we refuse to be defined by our enemies can we bless them. I know that's a mouthful, but it's not about us versus them. It's about us versus us. It's who we are now versus who we used to be. And it's not that we're not against our culture. Right? We're not against them. Instead, we now are freed up because we've been rescued to bless and to bring good news to our neighbors and to our culture. So here's the last thing that Peter talks about, and we'll be done. Peter says that we have power to be holy because we know what Jesus has done for us. We're going to take communion here in a few minutes. And if you leave today thinking, crap, I'm really unholy. I'm trying to be faithful. And I know that's oxymoron, but I'm failing at being faithful. I'm accommodating to the world around me. I'm not being distinctive the way God's called me to be. I look like everyone else around me. I need to like work harder. I need to start being more holy. Whatever that looks like, if that's what God's convicting you of, and you leave the day setting yourself with that goal, like, this week I'm going to be more holy, then you will fail. You will fail miserably. You will fail. Unless you remember what Jesus has done for you. In verse 18, he says, knowing. In verse 17, he says, conduct yourself with fear. Again, it's a call to holiness, right? Live with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing. Why? Because you know that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, knowing that you've been ransomed. Ransom is a picture of that you were slaves, that you were in a place of misery, slaves to futility, he says. And because you know that you've been ransomed from that, you've been freed from that, you've been bought out of slavery, not with silver or gold, but with something infinitely more precious. He says you were ransomed with, verse 19, the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. Here's the gospel, friends. Verse 20, that he was foreknown before the foundation of the world. Before the world was founded, God set in motion a plan to rescue his people. I know that's confusing, but this is the gospel, that God set out from the very beginning. He set out and put in motion a plan to rescue you from your futility and from your misery, to buy you out of slavery through the precious blood of Christ poured out on the cross. That's what communion is about. As you take the blood and the bread, we're remembering that we have been ransomed, that we were slaves to futility, that we've been rescued and ransomed and brought out of slavery and brought into his family. He says that we have been ransomed, and that this was a plan set in motion before the foundations of the world, and that's been manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Last phrase here, so that your faith and hope are in God. All of this has happened so that your faith and hope are in him. That's what we need to hear. That's the good news. You can't set out to live holy lives. You can't just decide to be more holy unless you know, and unless you remember, and unless you're freed up by the reality and empowered by the good news that you have been ransomed through no act of your own, but through the gracious gift of God, who gave his son as a lamb that went to the slaughter and died in your place, who suffered and died in your place because you were an unholy person. Because I was blemished, this unblemished lamb went and took my place. His blood was poured out. His body was broken. God raised him from the dead then, and God gave him glory, so that as a result, my faith and hope are in him. Not in myself, but in him. That frees us, friends, to live holy lives. That reality frees us to be a people that are faithful to our King in our workplaces and in our schools and in our neighborhoods, that wherever we are, that we can live faithful, not giving in, but we can faithfully follow Jesus even when we look different, because we've been rescued and we've been forgiven, and we have been made righteous, and our faith and hope are a result of his work, not our own. That's what frees us up to do this. So friends, as exiles, as a fellow exile for all of us, this is something we have to grow comfortable with, that we are not at home, that we are an exile, that we are gonna be different, that sometimes that means we face persecution, that sometimes it means we're going to be marginalized and pushed to the side. But in the midst of that, we set our hope completely on the future salvation, knowing that this world is not our home, and that we continue to follow him faithfully, living holy lives, knowing that we've been called out of futility and called into his kingdom, and that that's a good, life-giving place to be, and that we're able to do this, that we're freed up because he has rescued us, because he has forgiven us. Okay, it's all his doing. So go out this week and live different lives. Live faithful lives to Jesus as your King. Live holy lives. Be different in a way that is both repulsive and attractive to your neighbors. I know that seems like a contradiction, but it's not. Our lives should be both repulsive because it's so different, but also attractive because it's life-giving to the people around us as we faithfully follow Jesus, as we faithfully follow our King, and know that you're forgiven. Know that when you fail, every single time that's forgiven, that it's forgiven, that there's a lamb whose blood was poured out for you, that there's a lamb who was raised from the dead for you, that there's a salvation waiting for you, that you're being guarded for, that you have been born again by his doing, not your own, that it's all his work. Know that he's rescued you and he will one day save you. And it's not up to you, that he's the one doing this in you. All right, let me pray for us. As we take communion, we're gonna celebrate communion together. This is an opportunity for you to drink. We do this regularly because we have to remember this, to drink the juice and to eat the bread and remember that his blood was poured out for us, that his body was broken for us so that we could be forgiven and so that we could be brought out of slavery and ransomed and brought into his kingdom and set apart as his people. So let's take this together now, remembering what he has accomplished for us. Let me pray for us.